Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Real Networks and features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2008 annual conference presented by Stephen Worona, Director of Policy and Networking Programs for EDUCAUSE. The session is entitled P2P Provisions in the New Higher Education Act, What It Means for Your Campus.
Yes, thank you all for coming. Thank you all for coming this early. Is the mic picking this up? So this is a topic that is happening too early in the morning and shouldn't be happening at all, but nonetheless we are faced with it. Exactly. So I'll tell you a bit about how we got here and what we have to do now. The Higher Education Opportunity Act, as it was finally named, of 2008, was originally introduced in the Senate back in June 18th of last year. For the first month or so of its existence, there wasn't a word in that version of the bill about peer-to-peer or about this type of technology at all. And I will loop back to a number of these things later, but on a Thursday, on July 19th, Senator Reid, who is the leader of the Senate from Nevada and generally gets his way when he wants something, popped in some language that I will show you in a couple of minutes, and a number of us, and probably many of you, spent a frenzied weekend between that Thursday and the following Monday scurrying around to get that language removed from the bill, and we did succeed. And you can see that there wasn't that much time to do that because the Senate passed its version on the 24th, that is the following Tuesday. And so between the 19th and the 24th, we thought things were going to be really, really bad. But the version that passed was actually quite benign. And then a few months later, in November of 07, it got introduced in the House. And when it got introduced in the House, it had the Senate language, the benign Senate language that we finally ended up with, but a couple of requirements to produce plans. And a fair amount of time was spent working with House members between November and February to try to get that language changed, and I'll show you a bit about how that happened. And then this very interesting period between February of 08 and July of 08 went by when, political science 101, when the House passes a bill and the Senate passes a bill and those bills are different, well, there's only one bill that can be signed by the president, so there has to be a resolution of those two bills, and that's done by something called a conference committee. So between February of 08, when the House passed its version, so now we have both the House and the Senate with versions passed, and July, so March, April, May, June, July, 5 months, this conference committee met trying to resolve differences in the bills. And I'm not going to say that the three or four paragraphs that comprise the language having to do with peer-to-peer was one of the major points that was being debated during that five-month period, but it was one of the major, it was one of the points being debated during that five-month period. And there was just an amazing amount of arm wrestling, or more appropriately, mud wrestling, going on between higher education and the entertainment industry with members of the conference committee with respect to what language to actually write into the bill. So the conference report finally popped out on July 30th of 08. It passed the House and the Senate both the next day, and then a couple of weeks later it was signed into law by President Bush, and therefore it is now the law. So I'm going to talk about what the bill says, but actually I'm going to show you what it doesn't say. So here is the Reid language. However much hassle you think this may cause, and there really isn't going to be much, but however much or little hassle you think this is going to be, we're going to be faced with, imagine what we would have been dealing with if the Reid language had been passed. The Secretary of Education shall, on an annual basis, identify the 25 institutions of higher education participating in programs under this title, which have received during the previous calendar year the highest number of written notices from copyright owners. Any of you guys get DMCA notices, right? Would it be a good idea for legislatively to require the Secretary of Education to go around counting how many of those we all get, but not only count them, but notice who gets the top 25 alleging infringement of copyright uses, and that's just a bunch of language that essentially defines what a DMCA notice is. And from among the 25 institutions described there, the ones that have received during the previous calendar year, not less than 100. So they've got to be in the top 25 and have received at least 100. But of course, we know that the RIAA, MPAA, Business Software Alliance, et cetera, can crank these out with any number they want. You may remember from back in April, there was a spike. So the number of notices went up by a factor of 10. And the RIAA, of course, said, well, this doesn't mean that there's 10 times as much infringement going on. It just means we're changing the way we're generating the notices. This language came out in that same universe where those kinds of things can happen. So from among them, those that receive more than 100, so the Secretary of Education would have been legislatively mandated to take notice of the top 25 and notice which ones of those got more than 100. Now, for each of them, each eligible institution participating in any program under this title, this is the Higher Education Act, programs under this title include financial aid, which is among those identified by the, provide evidence to the Secretary that the institution has notified students on its policies and procedures related to the illegal downloading, et cetera, prove to the Secretary that you're notifying the students, undertake a review, which shall be submitted to the Secretary, of its procedures and plans related to preventing illegal downloading and distribution to determine the program's effectiveness and implement changes to the program if the changes are needed. Right? Submit this information to the Secretary of Education and provide evidence to the Secretary that the institution has developed a plan for implementing a technology-based deterrent to prevent the illegal downloading or peer-to-peer distribution of intellectual property. This was the Reed Amendment. Didn't pass. That's what we scurried around that weekend to prevent. And again, those of you who place phone calls, and there's a huge story about that. The Senate staffers were utterly astonished at the number of phone calls that came in over that 3-day period from all of the campuses in the country, talking about how bad an idea this would be. I'll give Senator Reed the benefit of the doubt. I think this was placed in front of him by the entertainment industry saying, no one's going to object to this. It's totally benign. This is the sort of thing that nobody cares about. And he and everybody else was surprised. Everybody else in the Senate was surprised when it generated the firestorm that it did. So thank you for helping to generate that firestorm. It also doesn't say this. This is language that was originally proposed in Tennessee a few months ago. Each institution of higher education shall, by January 15th of each year, thoroughly analyze its computer network. You may sense some common themes here, including its local area and internal networks, to determine whether it is being used to transmit copyrighted works, and either certify that an analysis indicates that the institution's network, including its local area and internal networks, is not being used to transmit copyrighted works, and that the institution has not received 10 or more legally valid notices of infringement, et cetera, et cetera. Is not being used to transmit copyrighted works. Does everybody here know enough about copyright to know that that's impossible? Right? Anything that is transmitted is by definition copyrighted. What they meant here were infringing works or unauthorized works, but that's not what the original version of the Tennessee law said. And or, so if you can't certify that, which of course you can't, take affirmative steps, including the implementation of effective technology-based deterrents to prevent the infringement of copyright, et cetera, et cetera. This was not part of the national legislation. This was originally proposed in Tennessee. I put this up here just to indicate that there are some pretty onerous and in some senses silly pieces of legislation coming along at the federal and state level. There is similar language that has been proposed in Illinois. And we are tracking other states, but I don't want to get too diverted to other things. But I at least wanted to let you feel a little better in terms of what we could have had. So what does it say? Here's the first part. What you have to do is make an annual disclosure to students. Now, those of you who've talked to your registrar or financial aid's officer probably know that the Higher Education Act has a long list of disclosures that have to be made. So here's one more, about financial aid and about fire alarms and all sorts of public safety things. You've got to disclose to students that unauthorized distribution, including peer-to-peer, may result in civil or criminal liability, right? You've got to disclose to them a summary of federal penalties for infringement. You pick them up out of the Copyright Act. I'm sure some best practice boilerplate will evolve from all of this. And a description of institutional policies, including disciplinary actions. Right? You tell your students that infringement is illegal. You tell them what the federal penalties are. You tell them what your own penalties are. This was word for word from the Senate bill. So when we got the read language out of the Senate bill, that's what the Senate came up with. It was carried forward into the act that finally passed. And we consider this benign. Is there anyone not already doing at least something like this? And don't necessarily shout out now, and if you want to say something during the Q&A, but if anybody considers this a problem, let me know. But that is in the law. But then, so that was in the Senate version, but then during that several month period when the House was working on the bill, here's the second part that is more problematic. Every institution has to certify to the Secretary of Education that the institution has developed plans to effectively combat the unauthorized distribution of copyrighted material, including through the use of a variety of technology-based deterrents, and certify that it will, to the extent practicable, offer alternatives to illegal downloading or peer-to-peer distribution of intellectual property, as determined by the institution in consultation with the Chief Technology Officer. Certify. Don't turn it in. The Secretary doesn't have to evaluate it. There's no criteria that says what the plan has to have or not has to have, because it doesn't have to be turned in. You just simply certify that you have developed a plan and that you will offer the alternatives. Develop a plan, not implement a plan, not analyze a plan, not turn it in. You know, all of the things that you've seen in other versions of this legislation is not here. Develop a plan. When we talked to the House and Senate staffers about what this would really mean, they say, what's the big deal about developing a plan? And when we were fighting this language, we say, well, look, we've got risk-averse attorneys, and apologies if there are any in the audience, but we've got risk-averse attorneys on campus who will say to our CIOs, well, have you developed a plan? And if the CIO says what the House and Senate staffers figured he would say, yeah, we've written a couple of sentences on a sheet of paper and tucked it in an envelope, isn't that good enough? The risk-averse attorney would say something like, well, we don't know. So maybe you should go off and spend the 2 or 3 or 4 man weeks that it might take to generate that plan. And now you've got tens or hundreds of millions of wasted dollars of opportunity cost throughout the higher ed establishment. Nonetheless, we are mandated to certify that we have developed plans to effectively combat. At various times, different words were used for this, and when we were, I'll use the word negotiating with the staffers about what words to put here, words like prevent were used, and we ran that by some of our members, some of you in the audience perhaps, and we're told, we can't certify that we've got a plan to prevent anything. There were words there like detect. And that caused some consternation in the community, because requiring that we have a plan to detect stuff suggests that we have a plan to monitor what's going on in the network with things like deep packet inspection. And so the final compromise was effectively combat through the use of a variety of technology-based deterrents. You've seen other language about technology in there. The other side, the recording industry, the Motion Picture Association, was absolutely insistent that the language in this bill refer to technology-based deterrence. That was just a line that they would not cross. And so the word variety was put in there to lighten the load, and I'll show you what that is being interpreted to mean in a couple seconds. Now, will to the extent practicable. During the several months when the House was putting this language in the bill, the phrase to the extent practicable popped in, and it popped in up at this level, saying that you've developed plans which to the extent practicable would do a couple of things. To my mind, this phrase might make sense up here when you're talking about technology-based deterrence doing something to the extent practicable. I don't know what "to the extent practicable" means down here. Not that I necessarily know what any of the rest of it is going to be taken to mean. Nonetheless, to the extent practicable, offer alternatives to illegal downloading. Offer. What does offer mean? What offer does not mean? We've heard this sufficiently frequently that I'm not concerned that this will change. What it does not mean is that every campus is mandated to go out and sign a contract with some commercial provider. I will give you at least one reason why that can't be what it means. And the reason that that can't be what it means is iTunes, because iTunes doesn't offer such licenses. And so if there were a federal mandate that every campus go out and make a site license with somebody like Ruckus or any of the others that might come up, that's essentially saying, iTunes, you're out of business with the college community. And it couldn't possibly mean that. So it doesn't, fear not. As determined by the institution in consultation with the chief technology officer, again, that is a phrase that used to be part of the overall language, the header of these two bullets, and might make sense in this section of the law. Nonetheless, here it is. This is the law. This is the law as written. Okay. I've already mentioned how we got here, that we had the words detect, we had the words prevent, practicable got stuck in there, chief technology officer got stuck in there. All of that happened during that time. It's this period that I want to spend some time talking about. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Good. So I have a new laser pointer. It's this period because this is when this is the period when this conference committee was meeting. That is, we now have a House bill passed February 7th with this language in it. We had a Senate bill passed July 24th of 07. So now between February and July, we are arguing about what the conference report should say and what language should show up in the conference report. The conference report, what's called the manager's report about a bill that generally exists for any bill where there has to be a conference committee aligning House and Senate versions, does not have the force of law. So when you are hauled into court because you violated law XYZ and your attorney says, "But Your Honor, my client didn't violate the law," you can't really go back to the conference report because that's not the law. But as you'll see later, there's a few more steps in figuring out how the Department of Education will create regulations for implementing this law. And those regulations will take this into account. And so it's worth taking a very careful look at what the manager said about this. They said, experience, and let me say again, this is an 1,100-page bill. The manager's report was also extremely large. The language that I showed you earlier in the bill about peer-to-peer is maybe 25, 30, 50 words. The manager's report about the peer-to-peer stuff in the bill is about 5 pages. So there's a lot of stuff there. And within those 5 pages, the managers say, experience shows that a technology-based deterrent can be an effective element of an overall solution to combat copyright infringement when used in combination with other internal and external solutions to educate users and enforce institutional policies, which seems like a quite reasonable thing to say. The manager's report also says, effective technology-based deterrents are currently available through a number of vendors. These approaches may provide an institution with the ability to choose which one best meets its needs, depending on that institution's own unique characteristics, such as cost and scale. These include bandwidth shaping, traffic monitoring to identify the largest bandwidth users, a vigorous program of accepting and responding to DMCA notices, and a variety of commercial products designed to reduce or block illegal file sharing. So there are 4 things that the manager's report is saying, for example, are included under effective technology-based deterrence. Because remember, the law says that our plan must effectively combat, there's the word effectively combat illegal file sharing considering the use of technology-based deterrence. Well, bandwidth shaping as far as the managers are concerned, is a technology-based deterrent. Traffic monitoring, as far as the managers are concerned, is a technology-based deterrent. A vigorous program of accepting and responding to DMCA notices is a technology-based deterrent. And then there's the commercial products, which other sections of the manager's report make clear, refer to things like Audible Magic and Red Lambda. So the several months of arm wrestling, mud wrestling, between higher ed and the entertainment industry gave us this language which seems to suggest, for example, that if you are running or have plans to run Packeteer or other bandwidth-shaping technologies, you are planning to offer technology-based deterrence. The managers also said, rapid advances in information technology mean that new products and techniques are continually emerging. Technologies that are promising today may be obsolete a year from now, and new products that are not even on the drawing board may, at some point in the not-too-distant future, prove highly effective. The conferees intend that this section, that's the section of the law, be interpreted to be technology neutral and not imply that any particular technology measures are favored or required for inclusion in an institution's plans. The conferees intend for each institution to retain the authority to determine what its particular plans for compliance with this section will be, including those that prohibit content monitoring. The conferees recognize that there is a broad range of possibilities that exist for institutions to consider in developing plans for purposes of complying with this section. Technology neutral, not imply that any particular technology measures are favored or required. Each institution retains the authority to determine what its particular plans will be, including institutions that prohibit content monitoring, and there's a broad range of possibilities that you can use. Content monitoring is okay. Technology neutral, pick any solution you want. The previous slide talked about, as far as they're concerned, a solution might include packet shaping. A solution might include enforcement of DMCA notices. A solution might have a heavy component of instruction to it. This is an amazingly enlightened section in the manager's report. And you can probably imagine that this is the part that was written by your representatives, by representatives of the higher education industry. Because when you turn the page in the manager's report, you see a totally different tone, which seems to be coming from a totally different document and a totally different viewpoint, which talks about the RU Legal program at Indiana University, which has education and enforcement and talks about how you can be expelled after the second or third strike or something along those lines. How the University of Maryland at College Park severely restricts bandwidth for residential networks and blocks certain protocols, and then again goes on to say after the third strike you can be totally taken off the network. The manager's report says Audible Magic identifies and blocks illegal sharing while allowing other legitimate P2P uses. That's in the manager's report. And the manager's report also says Red Lambda is able to detect all P2P, OS file sharing, FTP, IM, proxy use, Skype, and application tunneling over HTTP, HTTPS, DNS, and ICMP protocols. This is the House and Senate staffers writing a report with this language in it. Now, you figured that they went out and tested Audible Magic and Red Lambda. No. Presumably, the other side said, okay, look, if you're going to put in that sort of language that higher ed wants, here's the language that we would like on our side, taken out of the press releases from the technologies that we would like you to use. So yes, based on the manager's report, it is quite reasonable and is already happening that folks from the entertainment industry are saying, see, the law says that these are the right technologies that you ought to be using. Well, yeah. Or at least the manager's report says, but the manager's report also says technology neutral, any technology you want, the institutions have total control over what they decide to use, even if they prohibit content monitoring. So what often happens in legislation, a compromise is reached where both conflicting viewpoints are simply put into the same legislation, or in this case, the same manager's report, and now we can leave other people to work it out. So where do we go from here? From September to October, just ending a week or so ago, there were 6 public hearings. The Department of, so now we have a law which essentially instructs the Department of Education to enforce a whole lot of provisions that are in this 1,100-page bill, and it is now up to the Department of Education to figure out how to do that. In general, the way federal departments establish regulations is the staff from that department, whether it's the Federal Communications Commission or the Federal Trade Commission, or in this case the Department of Education, goes off, comes up with a set of rules, posts them in the Federal Register as something called an NPRM, a Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, for a certain period of time, 90 days is typical, solicits input from the public, responds to that input, puts up another notice of proposed rulemaking with modified rules, and that process iterates for a while until a final rule emerges. Well, the Department of Education works that way as well. However, for areas that are particularly troublesome, particularly difficult, where there are a lot of stakeholders with different opinions, the Department of Education goes through something called negotiated rulemaking. And I will say a little bit more about negotiated rulemaking. Negotiated rulemaking is a process by which negotiators, representatives of the various stakeholders, come together in panels, meet for a period of time, and try to reach consensus about what the rule should be. That is, rather than letting the Department of Education go off and figure out what the rule ought to be, you let the stakeholders sit down at a table and try to come up with a compromise solution. It is the rule for negotiated rulemaking that that agreed upon rules must be agreed upon by consensus. Consensus means no dissenting votes. Now that's not quite unanimity, so an abstention is okay. So if there's 10 people sitting around a table and 4 of them don't care about a particular topic, the 6 who do care, if those are the only ones who are voting and they all agree, then that's fine. But if one of the 6 who do care say no, that is a dissenting vote, and the negotiation therefore has not come up with a proposed rule. So there will be this negotiated rulemaking process for some of the provisions in this 1,100-page bill. The purpose of these hearings in September and October was to help the department figure out which of the provisions in the bill would be subject to negotiated rulemaking. Right? Not what the rule ought to be, not even who the negotiators would be, not even who the stakeholders are, but which ones will fall into the category of negotiated rulemaking. Sort of the higher education community, and that is EDUCAUSE and ACE and AAU and NASULGIC and all of our members and all of their members, came to the conclusion, not a unanimous conclusion, higher ed being, as they say, an opinion-rich environment, came to the conclusion that having P2P in the negotiated rulemaking process would be a good idea, because it would mean that the department was taking it seriously, that they were going to be careful about the rules, and not just sort of slap something together based on relatively uninformed, and they would not disagree with this, and I'll give you an example of this later, relatively uninformed Department of Education staff who really don't know that much about technology. So it was the feeling that we should try to get negotiated rulemaking to happen. So there were those 6 hearings, and I'll tell you about them in a minute. The department has said that before the end of the year, and I actually think it'll be a lot before the end of the year, I expect this to happen within another couple, 3 weeks, in fact, the Department of Education will announce which areas will be participating in negotiated rulemaking. In February 2009, the negotiated rulemaking panels will start meeting. And there's a wonderful FAQ, and I'll give you the URL for that, that talks about the procedures that the panels use. But after a few months, the negotiated rulemaking panels will finish. The notices of proposed rulemaking will start appearing for the areas that didn't go through negotiated rulemaking. For those things that went to negotiated rulemaking but didn't reach consensus, the department will then go out and come up with their own version of the rules, just as if negotiated rulemaking hadn't gone in place. But somewhere in this time, the final rules must be published by November 1st of 2009. And remember, if there's going to be a notice of proposed rulemaking, there's got to be time for public comment, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a relatively lengthy time before November 1st that at least initial versions of the rules have to start appearing. But the reason November 1st is such a key date is that because of the Department of Education's master calendar, the way the Department of Education works, in order for the Department of Education to start enforcing a rule on July 1st of any year, and July 1st is important because these things tend to be on a semester basis, right? So if you're going to have to do something beginning in the fall semester, you need to know what it is earlier than that, and that's taken to be July 1st. So in order for a rule to go into effect by July 1st, the rule has to be published, finalized, no changes, 100% done by November 1st of the previous year, right? So the earliest, since clearly nothing's going to happen by November 1st of 08, that's tomorrow, right? The earliest that the Department of Ed master calendar can kick in is with finalized rules a year from tomorrow, which will go into effect the following July of 2010. So in these hearings, we had of the six hearings. And I realized when I was putting these slides together that I never had checked on the last two. But I know we absolutely did get people speaking at four of the six hearings. The other side, the MPA and RA, only attended two of them. They were at Pepperdine. And at Pepperdine, Kate Hudson, who is a representative of the RIAA, people at these hearings were limited to 5 minutes. You could, of course, submit written comments, but you could submit written comments whether you spoke at the hearing or not. But the speakers were limited to 5 minutes, so they really couldn't say all that much. And Kate Hudson and Kent Wada, you're not here, are you? Okay, so Kent Wada from UCLA attended this meeting and gave me a report on it. And the one thing that I sort of grabbed out of his report was that the first thing Kate Hudson said was that peer-to-peer file sharing on university campuses is costing the entertainment industry 70,000 jobs. And therefore, Department of Education, you really need to dive in here and fix that. So that was her pitch. The only other one of the six hearings that the other side, that the RIA and MPAA attended, was the meeting in Washington, D.C. a few weeks ago when the choir was there in full force, or at least three of the people were there. There was somebody there from the RIAA, somebody there from Universal Music, and Stuart McLaurin from the Motion Picture Association. And all three of them essentially sang this tune, that what campuses need is they have to have a policy, but they have to enforce the policy. And Matt Gerson said cynically, and how many of them are really enforcing that policy? So you've really got to make them enforce the policy. That's item number two. But of course, and Gerson said this also, the only way to make the policy work is to put in blocks and filters. That's the technology-based deterrent. And of course, offer commercial alternatives. So the three of our friends from the entertainment industry were all pushing that agenda. And Stuart McLaurin made the point at the end of his 5 minutes, oh, and by the way, if this does go to negotiated rulemaking, we want a seat at the table. And of course, that's what higher ed was saying as well. We want a seat at the table. And several of the speakers at our request suggested that EDUCAUSE might be a good representative, but we will be having discussions if it does go to that point of who the representative will be. Don Spicer, and are you here, Don, by any chance? Don Spicer is with the University of Maryland system, and he gave a presentation. By the way, again, URLs for all this stuff is at the end. By the way, these slides have already been uploaded to the website for the conference, so all of this stuff is there. The transcripts for five of the six hearings, all except for the last one, which was in Cleveland, are all available online from the Department of Education website. The Department of Education has done an extremely good job of using the web for this particular process. So you can read Don's 5 minutes of testimony, but I was sitting there listening to Don describe how the University of Maryland system has 13 public universities, 185,000 students, 50,000 of them who are not even in North America. Huge variation among those 13 institutions. Two of them are research only with only grad students. One that has only professional schools. Two of them are adult ed oriented, that is non-traditional age students who are non-residents. inner city, suburban, rural, online, that among those 13 schools, there is no common approach to bandwidth or content management. And if you think about what sort of common approach would make sense to have on campuses that have a lot of resident students, that have resident undergrads versus resident grads, or that don't have resident students at all, the idea of a one-size-fits-all solution, even for one university system, Department of Education, listen to me about the problem that you are now dealing with, and if you're going to be setting rules, they need to be incredibly flexible, because there is a huge variation of possible solutions and possible needs for all of these technology solutions. So Don's point was made just brilliantly well, and if the department hears nothing but Don's presentation, they will be in good shape. But here was the interesting thing that happened. In nearly all of these hearings, and by the way, just in case it's not clear, these were full day, like 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. hearings, 5 minutes per person, so lots and lots of people. You could get anywhere from 3 or 4 people at a hearing if it wasn't well attended. 3 or 4 people speaking at a hearing, there are generally 20 or 30 or more people in the audience. But might be 3 or 4 people speaking, or 15 or 20 or 30 people speaking, because they've only got 5 minutes each. At most, you're going to get 2 or 3 people talking about peer-to-peer. Because again, 1,100-page bill, there's a whole lot of interest out there in financial aid and accreditation and safety issues and textbook issues and all sorts of other things that are included in the bill. So the point is that if we want the Department of Education to have a particular viewpoint on this, hearing something as coherent and incisive as Don's presentation was actually wonderful. So I do commend you to read it. But and most of the time, there were no questions from the Department of Ed panelists. They simply accepted the input. Thank you very much. Sit down. Pretty much the first question that was asked all day, and Don spoke right before a lunch break, pretty much the first question that was asked all day was asked to Don by David Bergeron. David Bergeron was one of the representatives of the Department of Education. And he said, thank you, Dr. Spicer. We've heard that some institutions are actually internet service providers. Could you please tell us how that impacts how you deal with these issues? Now, Don, and you'll see this in the transcript, said, I'm sorry, I'm hard of hearing. I'm not sure exactly what you said. And then he went and answered a different question because he hadn't heard the question. Okay. There was then a break. I went up to Bergeron and said, David, you realize that Don didn't answer your question. He explained why, because he's hard of hearing. But if you want to know about some of the issues about universities as ISPs and this stuff, I'd be happy to explain it to you. I don't know what the procedure is. We're on a break, so this isn't being recorded. I don't know if you need me to officially become a speaker so that I can read this into the record or whatever. And he let me go on for a while explaining what some of the issues were. And then he said, well, no, and you'll see that this isn't in the record, and I suppose it is now. What he told me during the break is, well, no, I simply wanted to get this question in the record. He didn't say exactly why, but then one of his colleagues on the panel said, yeah, because what do we know about regulating ISPs? What the Department of Education is essentially saying is they don't want any part of this. It's not something that where they feel they have any expertise. If they can find a way to duck it, and saying that this is a technology issue, these are ISPs, let the FCC or the FTC or somebody like that deal with it, that at least is where some of the staff, some of the employees of the Department of Education are coming from. They may or may not get their way. I mean, so we can think that we do have some allies there, but this remains an extremely profoundly political process. But we will be keeping this in mind as we go forward with our suggestions for how the department deal with these rules. What to do until the doctrine comes? Whether or not we know what it means, the law is in effect. And we, every campus in the country, is under the obligation to make a good faith effort to follow the provisions, but that good faith effort can certainly take into account the manager's report. So you are not stuck with simply those few ambiguous words like effectively combat in the law, but it is perfectly reasonable to look at what the manager's report says and on that basis decide how you're going to make a good faith effort to support it. So there's the timeline again. And we are here. And there are some resources. This is the main page, ed.gov, HEOA. And as I say, these slides have all been uploaded, so you can grab them from the conference website. No need to write any of this stuff down. This is the FAQ. I only put it on here. If I'd realized it was that long, I probably wouldn't have bothered, because there's a nice link from that page to get to the FAQ page. But I did want to remember to tell you that this FAQ is really quite good. On August 21st, I did an EDUCAUSE Live with Terry Hartle, 60 minutes. That is available, and you don't have to write down this URL either. I'll show you where to get that. The definitive, and this is what I come back to all the time. It is the document that I will always carry around whenever I need to talk about this, because in addition to having recommendations from EDUCAUSE, ACE, AAU, and the SELJIC for what to do, it also has the text, the relevant text of the bill, and the relevant text of the manager's amendment, all in one PDF file. And I'll show you where. Well, there's that URL. In the EDUCAUSE review, this month's EDUCAUSE review that you received with your registration, in your tote, you'll find an article in the policy at EDU section by me, called "On Making Sausage," that talks about all of this stuff. And the main place where you'll find more information than you want, which is part of the reason that I'm highlighting this stuff, is on our P2P file sharing, educause.edu/P2PFS page. And so all of these other links you will find somewhere on this page. If you ever find yourself on the page without another guide, just sort of do a text search on the page for the sorts of words that you're looking for, and you'll find what you want. So I'm going to leave that up there, and I have this actually ends at
on the hour.
Okay, yes. So I have 5 or 6 minutes for questions. Questions, comments. Yes, sir. Right. So the question, and I was asked to repeat the question because this is being taped. It's about the offer alternatives, and the question is, do I think it would be enough to simply call to the attention of the students that these alternatives exist? So my own opinion, take it for what it is worth, it strikes me that is exactly the type of thing that makes sense in the context of the fact that RUCKUS is no longer, as I understand it, correct me if you hear different on any of your campuses, is no longer offering site license-based, they no longer have a site license-based business model. RUCKUS is now offering its services directly to any individual with a .edu address. Now, my understanding is that they are continuing to honor all of the site license arrangements they've made up until now. They're just not making any new ones.
They are making arrangements with institutions to, for example, put servers on their campuses to still provide free services, but to make it to market it to the students. So they're still offering largely free arrangements with universities now.
Right. So the comment again, just to get it in the record, is that yes, while RUCKUS isn't making a business of marketing to institutions, they are allowing institutions to, or cooperating with institutions to, install servers on the campus to make the RUCKUS users on that campus operate more efficiently and save network bandwidth, presumably. Right, so yes, there are arrangements that can be made with RUCKUS, but from a business model, they are marketing right directly to their end users. iTunes markets directly to end users. So I'm not sure what would make sense to do beyond simply calling to the attention, which is not to say that you shouldn't, that if for some reason Some new vendor comes along with a really fantastic deal that for whatever reason your students or your administration thinks you want to latch onto. But the question is, what do you need to do to be in compliance with the law? And again, my own view, hopefully this will be codified within the Department of Education regulation so that we don't have to keep debating what it means. That the fact that calling that list to the attention of the students, so, you know, aggressively every semester, send out flyers, just do something to bring it to the attention, I think would count as offering. There was a point back there. Yes. Yeah. So again, to get it in the on the tape, the request was for what can EDUCAUSE do to help avoid the need for every campus to reinvent the wheel. And the two areas that are mentioned, number one is the disclosures, and the disclosures that would be common across all campuses, namely that infringement is illegal and what the federal penalties are. And the other is a list of commercial alternatives, of legal alternatives that campuses can point to. And yes, that point is very well taken. It has, things like that have been under discussion, and I fully expect that we will do something like that. Steve.
Two statements. One, in addition to that, in the past, EDUCAUSE has provided not just a single template, but examples from institutions that represent, in some senses, the best practices. I'm going to assume that EDUCAUSE will continue to do this in this area. Number one. Number two, I think that there is a larger issue for us. Do we want this to be considered a technology issue, as the Department of Education would seem to like to say, and say, look, it's a matter of ISP, and have it pushed in that area, or do we want to have it considered a matter of student conduct? I myself am torn, because I think ultimately it's a matter of personal conduct that students carry before they even come to us now, and that focusing on the technology will make it so that the entertainment industry will continue to push us, if not in the Higher Education Opportunity Act, elsewhere. But it's also true that that gets us out from under the Department of Education.
So I will repeat that, and this will, I just looked at my watch, this will be the last comment. Point number one was a third way that EDUCAUSE can help the community help each other, and that is, in addition to putting up standard templates, to highlight the best practice or effective practice sites that various campuses have come up with their own information or whatever variations they have made on the theme. And yes, we will certainly do that sort of thing. Point number two, which I'm going to put in the context of when we are suggesting to the department how it approaches these rules, whether the department approach them as a technology issue and whatever that might mean for the department, or whether the department approaches this as a behavioral issue. You know, if we are going to push in one direction or another for the way the department writes the rules, we should decide which way to go. And yes, indeed, and whether this goes through negotiated rulemaking or just to an NPRM, we are going to have some discussions among the community with respect to what we would like our negotiating position to be, what we are going to push for. Now, you realize, as I said a couple times, this remains extremely political. And in the timeline of what has happened so far, it was clear that there were a couple of times when it was absolutely essential for us to mobilize the community to make phone calls, and without that we would have been in trouble. But I hope it was clear that there were times when it was absolutely essential that the discussions and negotiations happen in back rooms without a whole lot of visibility in the community. And this issue about exactly where we want the department to go is going to fall somewhere in the middle there. So watch for what happens. We are out of time. Thank you all for showing up this early in the morning, and thank you for your attention.
This EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference podcast is sponsored by Real Networks. Stream multi-format audio and video to PCs and mobile devices with Helix Server from Real. Information at realnetworks.com.